from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our next Forum Hour, Paul Bowden became homeless at the age of 16, and in the decades since then, he's earned national recognition for his advocacy on behalf of the homeless. He ran the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness for 16 years, where he wasn't shy about criticizing the attitude that homelessness is only a problem if you can see it. And now he runs the Western Regional Advocacy Project. Paul Bowden joins us to talk about the current state of Bay Area homelessness and about his recently published book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs. Forum is ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Paul Bowden became homeless at the age of 16. In the decades that followed, he earned national recognition for his advocacy on behalf of the homeless. He's here with us this hour to talk about his work as a homeless organizer and crusader for 30 years. In that time, not only did he establish a national reputation as one of the country's leading advocates, but he became homeless, as I said, when his mother died at the age of 16 and went on to become director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, as well as a board member of the National Coalition on Homelessness. Presently, he works as the director of RAP, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and he recently published a book called House Keys, Not Handcuffs. It's all about his work organizing on behalf of the homeless. The book also delves into art and politics related to homelessness. And Paul Bowden joins us in studio for the second hour of Forum. Good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Nice to be here.
I guess a place to begin, and this is something that you published an op-ed on a couple of years ago in the Chronicle, is how you do this head counting. How do you determine who's homeless? We've done programs in recent history on the rise in numbers of families, rise in number of children. But the problem is you've got, and it's coming up, every January 25th, people out there counting heads on who's on the streets, and it's not a very effective, nor is it a very, in many ways, accurate way to define the number of homelessness or people who are homelessness. It pretty much accounts for mainly single adults, doesn't it?
Well, it depends on how we define effective. It's very effective if you want to be able to say that the numbers of homeless people have gone down. And it's very similar to when Reagan first came into office, the unemployment numbers were still really high. If you recall, we had a recession in the late 70s. And so they redefined when somebody counts as being unemployed. It used to be not having a job put you in the unemployment numbers. They changed it to not receiving receiving unemployment benefits or being in an unemployment program, job training system. That became the number of people that are unemployed. That's still the way we determine the number of unemployed Americans today. So it was very effective in terms of Reagan being able to say the neoliberal economic policies that he brought with him as part of his revolution were reducing the numbers of unemployed people. HUD decided to do the same thing. They wanted to promote the chronic homeless program. They wanted the chronic homeless program to be the success so that the 10-year plans could be deemed a success, the 10-year plans that are now 14 years old. But they wanted to be able to promote that this was the system. This was working. So they redefined when families and youth are determined to be homeless. So doubled up, tripled up, living in SRO hotel rooms, sleeping on couches, no longer qualified you as being counted as a homeless person, and started focusing all of their data on determining what was happening with the visible homeless. And the rationale from HUD at that time and the Interagency Council for the Homeless, the national federal agency, was to order to document success and get support for homeless programs, we needed to reduce the numbers of visible homeless. And that's where the point in time headcount, that's where the redefinition of homelessness, all of those systems were put in place. And since HUD is the funder of local governments implementing their homeless programs, the local governments all go along with it.
And HUD has essentially, I mean, from your perspective, and just generally dismantled affordable housing units, haven't they?
Oh, not, you know, it's documented. There's hardcore numbers. You go to the Without Housing Report on our website. You go to the federal budget. From 79 to 82, over $54 billion a year in affordable housing funding was eliminated that has never come back. Never come back. And we started opening our emergency shelter program. San Francisco opened their first shelters on the floor of St. Anthony's, on the church pews at Episcopal Church, on the floor and in chairs at Hospitality House, where I came up through, in October of 82. So there's a direct cause and effect to the massive decimation of affordable housing funding that took place in the early 80s. And the advent of contemporary homelessness. And there's a massive cause and effect in documenting that we ain't addressing this stuff because we have never restored that affordable housing funding. In fact, with HOPE 6 and now with what they call RAD, which is mortgaging off public housing, the low-income housing tax credit program where companies can make money by investing in affordable housing funding, which now has to use housing vouchers in order for people to be able to afford to live in those units. All of these systems that were put in place have done nothing but exacerbate the problem.
You talk about your own coming up through Hospitality House. They were giving you Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky back in the day, which, of course, a lot of people think was a Bible for Barack Obama when he was a community organizer in Chicago. And I want to talk about your history, but you have that vantage point and you have the advantage of having gone through all that history. And you've seen, and you write about this, you've seen the changes from talking about systemic causes to sort of it's their fault.
Well, and I equate – now, I mean, there's two things here. One is my homelessness had nothing to do with affordable housing funding being decimated. My individual circumstance was about a mother that died and a father that was a jerk. So I grew up middle-class white boy, Long Island, good school system, good baseline education. I've got a GED. I never even finished high school, but I still had a better baseline education than 85% of my friends that I was hanging out with while I was out in the street because most of them grew up in really poor neighborhoods. So even though they had a high school diploma, I still was able to have that white privilege advantage of being able to manipulate the system, being able to come across with this absolute attitude, which people claim I still have. I feel like
it's part of your charm, Paul.
Well, thank you so much. There's mayors that would disagree.
Most of them would disagree.
But I feel that I'm entitled as a human being to be treated with dignity and respect.
Forgive me, most of the San Francisco mayors. Let me make that clear. Because I know you're working in different states now, and I want to get into that as well. But when you talk about dignity and respect, you're also talking about, and have been talking about for years, just human right.
Absolutely. And that would be the baseline. I mean, why wouldn't a government of people, which theoretically, I guess before the Supreme Court decision, we were supposed to be a government of the people, why wouldn't you want people educated? Why wouldn't you want the people you're governing to have access to excellent health care and dental care? Why wouldn't you want people to have a decent place to live? I mean, why is that considered bad and wrong? Why? And then in the 60s with the war on poverty, we put it into this charity mentality and we created nonprofits and 501c3 tax exempt. And in those systems, it says you cannot do systemic change work. You have to do charity work. So like we set up a system as part of the war on poverty that created the private industry council, that created the economic opportunity commissions, that created giving out peanut butter and cheese out the back of trucks for people as if that was going to deal with poverty. United Way comes along. They put out books about doing well by doing good to show people how to set up foundations and actually make money off of the process. And we wonder why systemically it keeps getting worse. And the reason that the disparity between the rich and the poor, the reason the level of poverty, I mean, we're not talking substandard housing. We're talking no housing whatsoever.
And we're mortgaging public housing now to a great degree.
In order to fund it.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense.
Which is kind of crazy. But also, I mean, how much does the lack of, we keep hearing about the lack of stock of housing, how much does that play in? We keep hearing about gentrification, and particularly with, you know, tax breaks to Twitter and the like, and people see this as forming even a greater barrier with respect to ameliorating the housing problem for homeless people.
And it's where we really need to look at what is neoliberal economics and what kind of impact is it having in America today? Because it, I believe that it was the core of the Reagan Revolution, that we had tried this stuff with the United Fruit Company and the creating the banana republics down in South and Central America in the 60s and even up through the 70s. And we saw the impact, and back to the 50s, I meant. And we know how these systems work, where government is responsible to make sure that corporations are making money. And so long as money is being made off of the government endeavor, it is economic stimulus, and it's important, and it's a value that we cherish. If nobody is making a profit off of it, if nobody is generating income off of it, it's charity, and it's a drain on our system, and we can't afford it, and we just don't have the resources for it. And we need to really subjugate the people that are receiving these services based on, do you have a felony record? Where were you born? Are you having guests? Like today, somebody living in public housing by law and by lease is not allowed to let somebody sleep on their couch. How intrusive, and then how minutia are you going to get in controlling the lives of people that are living in subsidized housing by even getting to the point of telling them who they can, whether or not, not even who, whether or not people are allowed to sleep on their couch? Should a family member have a crisis? Should a cousin be over to visit? So like that kind of two different standards. One is economic stimulus because there's money being generated, there's profit being generated off of this endeavor. And the other is things that benefit people, public parks, education systems, housing, things that everybody needs, that everybody values, and everybody should have access to by virtue of the fact that they're a freaking human being. And we consider that a drain and a negative and something that we can't afford to do. So the end result of that is that same period of time from 79 to 83, when the affordable housing funding was being decimated, the homeowner mortgage interest deduction program went from $44 billion a year to today it's at $144 billion a year. So we did not stop subsidizing housing. The government subsidizes housing at a rate today greater than it's ever subsidized housing before. The difference is we reprioritize the type, the form of housing that we are willing to subsidize. So if it's home ownership, where the mortgage companies and the real estate interests and the construction companies are making money off of it, then it's a good housing subsidy. And we even wrote at the request of the Joint Committee on Taxation staff people, we said, we want to know exactly how much money is going out of our pocket as the taxpayers in the form of housing subsidies for home ownership. And they wrote us back and said, we don't know. Nobody is tracking it. So it's so valuable, it's so important that they don't even track the final number of expenditures that are allocated. And I say expenditures deliberately because if you owe me $50 and I tell you to keep it, I just gave you $50. If you ask me for $50 and I hand you a $50 bill, I just gave you $50. It's exactly the same thing. So we do subsidize housing. We just don't subsidize housing if that housing happens to go to poor families and to poor individuals.
Talking to Paul Bowden, and as you can tell, this is a subject which he has maintained passion about low all these many years that he's dedicated himself as an advocate for the homeless. His book is House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. And I'll talk about how you can get the book. Those of you who want to get a hold of it, it's all nonprofit and it's all for the fundraising of his group, RAP. I want to talk to you, though, Paul, about some of the analogies you make in what you've just laid out for us about the recession and Reagan and, you know, subsidizing housing still, but not for groups of people. In fact, you've even said that it's sort of like the homeless have become like the so-called Okies, not a word I like to use, but those who came from Oklahoma and the kind of thing that Steinbeck pictured for us in Grapes of Wrath, or Jim Crow laws. It's a kind of history repeating itself as you see it, but against those who deserve human rights and who deserve to have subsidized housing. In many people's minds, though, they don't deserve it. In many people's minds, you know, you hear the argument. I've heard it through the years here behind the microphone. These are people who have to get off their duffs, you know, do things for themselves. Why should we, the taxpayers, take that burden? In fact, a lot of that, you know, was consistent with the Reagan view of things. And you say what to that argument?
I
the government shouldn't have to pay that role. You know, you hear it from libertarians.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, and it's funny, you don't hear it. You hear just the opposite when you talk about changing the homeowner mortgage interest deduction program. You don't hear it when you talk about military spending. You don't hear it when you talk about corporate welfare, which far exceeds any kind of assistance that is allocated for poor people. So I guess you would have to break this down to an issue of parity. If government shouldn't subsidize housing, then government shouldn't subsidize anybody's housing. If government shouldn't subsidize economic development, it shouldn't subsidize economic development for anybody. So get rid of the lunch write-offs. Get rid of the luxury boxes at AT&T Park or whatever. You know, get rid of corporate welfare. If you're going to say government can't afford freaking food stamps for poor people, we can't afford food stamps for poor people, but we can afford massive tax breaks for industry. And we just saw it. They just passed the bill, and it's got massive tax breaks for corporate interest and for moving businesses overseas.
Corporate interests, you know, have the lobbying power that those of you who advocate on behalf of the homeless obviously don't have. There's the major difference. It's all, it all has to do with campaign finance, and it all
but
has to do
I
with
But I think
funding.
It's how we need to reframe this debate. This isn't about is somebody moral or not. When I'm a homeowner now, and you would think San Francisco would use me to highlight what a successful homeless program we have, because I went from being homeless to I'm a homeowner. Nobody questioned me. Nobody asked me if I had ever been arrested. Nobody asked me who sleeps over at my house. Nobody called me a drain on society and said I should be sweeping streets like they said when I was living in a shelter. All of a sudden, I'm now morally, ethically eligible to receive government benevolence as a homeowner when I wasn't as a poor person.
Well, that morality you speak of brings us right into the Homeless Bill of Rights, which I know you're advocating for and
Rapp
is advocating for. We're talking about criminalization of homeless people, whether they're sleeping in their vehicles that are legally parked or whether they're sitting or standing or eating or doing any kinds of things that they've been cited for. And again, the whole picture of what you're trying to advocate for here, same rights for the homeless people that anybody else has.
Well, it's ironic to me that local governments are able to create laws that, you know, in advance, even the people that write the laws are going to break, because everyone's going to sit down at some point. Everyone's going to stand still. Everyone's going to eat. And everyone's going to sleep. You know, at the time that you write that law, it is only going to get enforced against certain people. And so you are automatically, even before you get out the gate, even before the bill passes or Newsom puts it on the ballot as part of his campaign for mayor to make it illegal for people to sit on a sidewalk, even before any of that happens, as you're crafting that piece of legislation, you know damn well it's going to be discriminatorily enforced. When we look at, and we have this on our website as well, so I'm not just woofing here, all of this stuff that I'm talking about, we have documented, and it's on the website with citations. Jim Crow's laws were set up the same way. Anti-Okie laws were set up the same way. Ugly laws were set up the same way. Japanese-American exclusion, Bassereau Treaty. This country has sundown towns. This country has a long, repetitive, I guess that's redundant, but a long history of periodically creating sets of laws that are written and passed by local governments, pushed by local business community members, enforced by local police departments, adjudicated in local courts, and people are incarcerated in local jails. And because it's all under the time, place, manner restrictions that local governments have the legal authority to oversee, the state and the federal governments are told to stay the hell out of it. This is local. This is local issue. These are local laws. The state and federal government needs to stay out of it. And so they do. And what happens is poor people or people of color or Japanese American people or people from Mexico or disabled people are removed, and the attempt is made to remove them from local communities using these either citations and then they become bench warrants or in many cases misdemeanor offenses and you can get arrested right away.
So the Homeless Bill of Rights, which you're proposing and which you're actually lobbying for in other states, and I know you're going into kind of street outreach the way labor union organizers do and all of that sort of thing, this is essentially to what? Wipe out that criminalization of homelessness?
Yeah, it's a little bit broader than that in the sense that, yes, it would definitely protect homeless people from being discriminatorily policed. It would also, I mean, our street outreach, which is now over 1,500 people that we've interviewed, you know, the top three criminal offenses that people are being charged with are sleeping, sitting, and standing still, loitering, they call it. We call it standing still. Those are the top three criminal offenses that people in five states and 12 communities, over 1,500 people, and I'm talking by percentages of 81% when it comes to sleeping, of 78% when it comes to sitting, of 70-something percent when it comes to loitering, standing
still.
Chris,
a lot of
this
is what used to be called vagrancy, and a lot of merchants and homeowners don't necessarily want people that they think of as vagrants or bums or whatever you want, and in some instances, frankly, criminals, to be in those places.
And how is that different from when those people didn't want people that were black, or those people didn't want people that were Chinese, or didn't want people that were Catholic, or didn't want people that were Irish? I mean, why is it that just because these are racist laws that are implemented and carried out at the local level, we step back and say, oh, well, it's a local issue, so we'll just stay out of it? We say, no, the time has come to not just stop the anti-homeless policing stuff, whether they call it safer cities or sidewalk management or quality of life laws, regardless of whatever they call it. We need to not just stop the current trend of homeless people being the target, and God forbid if somebody is homeless, big, black, and mentally ill, they're going to be in jail at some point. That's almost guaranteed. So, and when you look at our jails, you know that I know exactly what I'm talking about when I say that. That's almost a no-brainer. So we don't want to just stop what is currently happening. We want to make damn sure that the next target group, the next group, maybe they be Muslim American, who knows, but there'll be a next group. If history is a teacher, which in fact it is, there will be a next group of people that get targeted by this kind of police enforcement programs, and we want to make sure that it never happens again. So what we're saying is you cannot criminalize life-sustaining activities that we know darn well everyone's going to commit, because your body's going to tell you to sit down whether you want to sit down or not. Your body's going to tell you to rest. Your body's going to tell you to eat.
Paul Bowden is with us in studio. His new book is House Keys, Not Handcuffs, and there's some artwork in here, Art Hazelwood and Bob Prentice. Get into the artwork perhaps as well. But what we really want to get into is what's on your mind and find out what's on your mind in terms of homelessness. By the way, the book can be actually ordered through the website, which is raphome.org, WRAPHOME.org, and it's all for fundraising purposes. In the meantime, if you'd like to join this conversation, if you have some thoughts, some sentiments, some questions or comments about homelessness, its history, or where it's going in terms of ameliorating the problems that we're bringing up here, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Join us again at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Paul Bowden, Executive Director of RAP, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs. He's been organizing around homeless issues in San Francisco for 30 years and is now certainly not only become a national advocate, recognized as a national advocate of doing something about the problem of homelessness, but also moving this homeless bill of rights in particularly Oregon as well as California. There's a homeless bill of rights day of action. Actually, a day of action, we'll give it a plug here, Paul. It says, January 15th to the 21st in Berkeley, Chico, Oakland, Los Angeles, Portland, Sacramento, and San Francisco. And you can be part of it by contacting RAP at raphome.org. And there are a lot of pictures here. And We're going to go to your calls and emails. And by the way, you can call us and join this conversation at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Or if you'd like to communicate your thoughts or if you'd like to bring questions before us and to Paul Bowden, you can do that by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. A quote from Martin Luther King, a right delayed is a right denied. Excuse me. But there's also a lot of pictures here. I want to just, before we get our listeners involved in this, I wanted to just briefly talk with you a bit about posters and art and the role of artwork. There's a lot of stuff that Art Hazelwood has that mm-hmm. is part of your book. And these were, essentially denouncing on behalf of the poor and those who were homeless, the dehumanizing of homelessness. It was also directed against media, the criminal system, vigilantes, government, corporations. There's pictures here of somebody standing with a police phalanx, Jim Crow, anti-Okie laws, broken windows, sundown towns, ugly laws, Safer Cities Initiative, as if all of these kind of congeal or go together.
They do. And you know, what's so amazing about the artwork, and it goes all the way back to the beginning of the street sheet and stuff, is you want to convey a message. Artwork needs to be a big part of it. You know, the more artistic, the more high energy, the more we're very nonviolent, we're very passionate. And to be able to display that through your artwork, and the fact that the organizers and the homeless people themselves are part of creating the images that become the artwork that is used, shows that it is really about conveying a message. It's another form. We can write books. We can write street sheet articles and other, you know, we have 5 member street newspapers in RAP. But when you're in Portland, you're in Denver, you're in San Francisco, L.A., Sacramento, you need, in order to have a consistent message that goes out to everybody, your organizers work with the artists to say, here's what we found in our street outreach. Here's what we found in our research. And they work with us to portray images that resonate with that, that speak to that. We started it with
some scary images, you know, in the case of Hazelwood.
Sometimes they're scary, and other times they're very, you know, powerful in other ways. But, you know, same way when we have our actions, which we'll be having on the 18th and 19th this week at the BART station turnaround on Powell Street. We use music. We use street theater. When we did a 14-city day of action on April Fool's Day around the business improvement districts and the power that they have, where they've changed our downtown neighborhoods into business improvement district areas, we use street theater. You know, like, it's, we want people to come to these actions going away feeling empowered and feeling like they were at a party, because we're not victims. We're getting what we're willing to put up with. And the more we can bring social justice, religious people and daycare people and domestic violence workers and immigrant rights workers and day labor people and housing developers, the more we can bring our community together like that in terms of social justice for all people, the more creative and high energy and the more fun we're going to have as we fight to change the system.
You want also, presumably, just some good, caring citizens who don't fit into any of those categories. But I was interested in reading some of your argument about having to write grants, and they want to know about leadership programs. And you said, you know, we need people in the trenches. We need people who will clean the bathroom. And in fact, you were talking about leadership and movement and separating leadership from movement and saying Martin Luther King, for example, was not – the movement created Martin Luther King. But you have been a leader in homelessness. I mean, you reflect to some extent a catalyst for a lot of action. I'm not trying to, you know, stroke you here, because I don't need to do that and you don't need it. It's not my style. But the truth of the matter is, leadership plays a very fundamental role, doesn't it, in terms of catalysts and getting things in action?
In the way that the and I think Jenny Friedenbach, who is the current director of the coalition, you know, is saying the same things and is putting out the same messages that we were putting out when I was there, because both of our jobs are to reflect what people are saying, to document what they tell us, and then reflect that out to the broader community. If we wanted to find that as leadership, fine. But I'm also the one that takes the minutes. I'm also the one that had to unclog the toilet whenever it broke. So, you know, I feel that poor people and homeless people especially, and you look at the experts on homelessness, you look at who is defined as the homeless experts, you don't see people that are poor or ever been homeless. So, you know, and all of a sudden they'll interview a homeless person when it's like, well, how did you become homeless and how did you stop being homeless and how did you – but in terms of a policy analysis, in terms of research that's been done, in terms of artwork that's been created, you don't see the homeless people themselves identified as the experts on the issue of homelessness.
Well, part of this is what you spoke of in the beginning of this program about the invisibility of homelessness. But I want to mention, by the way, that there's a plan to end the homelessness in Santa Clara County. It goes before their supervisors this week. The new plan proposes bringing together diverse funding sources to build 6,000 new units of housing. This was reported on our news earlier. Let me, since we talk about what's my style and not my style, I like to think my style is pushing back somewhat. Let me push back on a couple things here, and then we'll get our callers and listeners involved. This is from the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce newsletter published March 2014. Despite the city's significant investment to combat homelessness, approximately $200 million per year, the number of people living on the street remains relatively unchanged. So is spending more the answer? And services, that is, spending more.
I think despite the city's investment, it doesn't come close. And this thing with Santa Clara, they tend to always announce these new initiatives to end homelessness right after sweeping hundreds of homeless people out of encampments. So if you recall, they just recently.
San Jose, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you tend to get, I could see where people get whiplash going back and forth. Like, what are we criminalized? Are there point in time headcount numbers accurate? Are the you know, 1.2 million children in public school every day that are homeless, but HUD says there's only 600,000 homeless people in the whole country? So people, I think, unless you're up in the mix of it, it's very easy to get whiplash in terms of what's going back and forth. When you look at the number of affordable housing units that were lost through HOPE 6 in San Francisco, when you look at the amount of federal funding for affordable housing development, the amount of state funding for residential treatment for indigent, mentally ill, and people with suffering from substance abuse, and you compare what the city might be spending, and a lot of that is also HUD McKinney money that the city administers. But
that figure, $200 million,
they don't compare.
The figure of $200 million, I mean, it must be sometimes frustrating to you when you look at that amount of money. It is certainly from the Chamber of Commerce's point of view. You look at that amount of money and you say, where's the decrease in the number of people who are living on the streets?
Right, because we're not – it's that old axiom about there's babies coming down the river and you can spend all your time pulling each baby out of the river as they come down, or you can go upstream and figure it out what's putting all these babies into the river in the first place. When you go back to 79, before San Francisco had a homeless program, before they put the Muni buses in front of St. Anthony's in the old welfare building, and Herb Cain wrote an article and they put an awning out because we were all standing out in the rain waiting to sleep on buses. Before that, we didn't have these programs. There wasn't a Hamilton family shelter, not because we were cold and heartless and mean, because we didn't have all these families sleeping in without any housing.
All right, we got a lot of callers. We got a lot of emails. I want to get our listeners involved. One quick pushback, though. You were talking about local communities. Local communities that, let's phrase it this way, boost services unilaterally run the risk of becoming magnets for homelessness? Might say that's what happened in San Francisco.
It's funny. We looked at 58 communities. Eureka is currently claiming they're the big magnet for homeless people. We looked at 58 communities in California and in the state of Washington. In California, on average, there were 9 laws on the books already making it illegal to sit, stand, sleep, or eat. So there's everybody is putting these laws on the books, and everybody has the legal authority and has the pattern and practice of enforcing these laws. So no matter where you go in California, there's on average 9 laws on the books targeted to give police the authority to make you disappear.
And Paul Bowden is our guest. His book is House Keys, Not Handcuffs. And Hospitality House, which we mentioned before, is presenting a community roundtable on homeless organizing, art, and politics in San Francisco Tuesday, February 10th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Kelly Cullen Community, 220 Golden Gate Avenue. Let's go right to your calls and not Terry here on that score. And we'll bring John in first from Alameda. John, hi.
Good morning. I just wanted to share my story with you. I think most people don't understand how easy it is to become homeless, and a lot of people are on the brink of being homeless or just one paycheck away from being homeless. I myself, I'm college educated, went to graduate school, but I have no savings because I spent all of my money on school, and I took my chances at a job in the Silicon Valley because the employer gave me false assurances of job security. They told me I had a job for 5 years. A year later, they said they were slowing down. They laid me off. It was the middle of the month. I basically had 2 weeks to find a job and make a $1,600 a month rent payment just for a junior one-bedroom apartment. Obviously, couldn't make it that fast. Ended up sleeping in a storage shed for 2 weeks. I found a sympathetic relative, but not everybody is lucky as I am. I had family to back me up, and I just wanted to make the point that it can happen to anybody. The unemployment system, it takes 4 weeks to process your first check. And one stupid little clerical error in your paperwork will delay your payments for weeks. I mean, the cost of living has almost doubled in the last 10 years. And then, you have nowhere to go when you're homeless. And so I'm very, I have a new respect for homeless advocates and also a new respect for the family that helped me out.
John, good of you to call, and particularly to make people mindful of how easy it is to fall into homelessness one check at a time, as so many people live, and I thank you for that. Paul, you want to comment?
Well, I just think what's so ironic is if that family had been living in public housing, they could have lost their housing just for helping him out. And that's what I'm talking about. If you're poor enough that your family members are living in public housing, and you end up in a situation where you're in the same boat as him, they turn around to be humane and to be a good family member and help you out, and they jeopardize and run the risk of losing their own housing just for doing so.
More of your calls. We'll go next to Rancho Cordova. Ken, hi. You're on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I just wanted to comment that I think your analogizing race and homelessness is really a bad analogy. Problems such as aggressive panhandling and public urination, et cetera, are not a racial problem. And I think in a way you're kind of missing, you're missing an opportunity to really get at the root of the problem by focusing on local laws that try to deal with a homeless problem that the local communities, you know, aren't the cause of. The cause is issues, things at the state and federal level, such as closing mental health institutions, not providing funding for halfway houses, and things like that are the thing that are causing homelessness.
And let me add to that, if I may, Ken, because I'm looking at a number of emails here, a lot of people pointing out the relationship between homelessness and substance abuse.
Yes, exactly. It's a mental health issue, yeah, to a large extent. Local governments have no other way of dealing with these problems other than to criminalize the behaviors that are harmful to the community. It's not they don't like homeless people. It's that they don't, and they're not that they're not sympathetic to homeless people. It's that they've got nothing else they can do. And it's certainly not a racial issue. It's just that's the worst analogy I can think of.
Well, let's hear from Paul Bowden on that. Thanks, Ken, for the call.
I think that homelessness is an issue of poverty, and I think that poverty is an issue of racism and classism. And I in everything that I've ever seen, when you look at mental illness, let's use that as an example, or even substance abuse, it's not only poor people and homeless people that suffer from mental illness or suffer from substance abuse. It's the lack of ability to access a residential treatment or consistent treatment system and treatment program in order to address that illness. That is why they end up out in the street. So to say that poverty isn't an issue of race and class, and that the policies that the federal government and the state governments implement around, you know, why should panhandling is a manifestation of poverty. It's not a manifestation of homelessness. Homelessness wasn't created by panhandling. Homelessness wasn't created by people sleeping in the park and suddenly deciding in 1983, hey, you know what? I don't need this housing stuff. I want to go sleep in doorways. I want to go sleep in the park. The incarceration rates of African-American mentally ill people in local jails for what judges call nuisance crimes is absolutely off the hook. So to say that race and class don't play a role in the massive amount of poverty that we are seeing manifest itself out on our streets today and in our parks today, I think is missing the point.
Well, I thank the caller, and I'm going to go to an online comment from Beth who says, I'd love to hear Mr. Bowden speak of the value of tiny houses on wheels. More and more people, including myself, are tiny house folks. A well-equipped tiny house off-grid could be made for $5,000. Yet so many cities and towns do not seem supportive. Housing is a need and a human right, and a tiny house on wheels could be one answer for many people.
I would take it over congregant shelters in a heartbeat. And I think that, especially for people that have never had to sleep in a shelter, congregant shelters were created, meaning big, large shelters or even, you know, any shelter over more than three people. they were created as a short-term emergency response to what was seen as a crisis back in the early 80s. They've become a tier of housing. If tiny houses were to be used to give it another alternative to congregant shelters, I would think it's great. I don't believe that it was lack of tiny houses that created homelessness, so I don't see how tiny houses is going to solve homelessness. But I do agree with the woman that sent that in, that it should be something that local communities embrace, because it's clear that homelessness after 32 years can't be considered a short-term solution, and that these 10-year plans and 5-year plans that have been created aren't going to address it. But I would always go back to without housing. The reason that we focus on without housing and on the Homeless Bill of Rights is because in every community that we represent, in from Portland to Denver and all the cities in between, 135 organizations are part of this campaign. The impact of the affordable housing cuts for housing from the federal government and the policing of homelessness and poverty and poor kids of color and day laborers and the way that these local laws are being used to try to make those folks disappear are systemic throughout all of our communities. So they are the two issues that RAP focuses on the most.
We are talking to Paul Bowden, who is the executive director of RAP, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs, and he's been organizing around homeless issues in San Francisco and beyond for 30 years. Here's Diane, who writes, in my work with this population, I found that every single person living on the street is dual diagnosis, alcohol or drug addiction and mental illness. To think that someone like this has the judgment to make decisions is a callous and out-of-date understanding of the topic of judgment. I believe we should shift away from the civil liberties model, which presumes judgment where there is none, and move it to a public health model where this is considered an issue where society needs to treat this as an issue of public health in terms of disease, social degradation, and making decisions for people who cannot make their own decisions. It's a whole issue of autonomy.
Well, there's also a whole issue there of every single person.
No, she's wrong about that.
I'm sorry. She's wrong about that. I find it hard to debate an argument that starts out that blatantly.
But let's revise it. Let's say many, many people out on the streets are incapable of making or determining judgments and being autonomous and having the kind of agency that we would expect with, you know, having subsidized housing, for that matter, even, or being able to have the kind of housing support that you're looking for. Let me actually go to another.
Let's open up West Side Lodge again. Let's open up Chateau Agape again. Let's get the Northeast Lodge back online. Let's refund, you know, the programs that were set up when deinstitutionalization took place. People keep thinking that we went straight from deinstitutionalization and closing the big large facilities into the streets. It didn't. There was about a 5-year window where the state was funding residential community-based treatment. Berkeley had some great programs. Conard House came out of that system. Baker Place came out of that system. Mm. You know, it was a good idea, and it was smart. And within 5 years, when Governor Reagan decided to defund it, these people started ending up out in the street. Let's deal with that.
Sam writes, recently, Palo Alto and Los Angeles have passed laws against camping in cars, and Los Angeles was even impounding people's cars. This is problematic at face value. Where are the homeless expected to sleep? Worst, this is grounded fundamentally on the NIMBY attitude of histrionic business people and middle-class homeowners. People used to camp in their car in the library parking lot near my house, and I enjoyed their presence within the community. The wealthy elitists in Palo Alto, however, couldn't see past the poverty long enough to recognize the humanity of the homeless. Where do Palo Altans expect the homeless to go? Do they expect them to survive without sleep or to just die? It is shameful. Sam writes, when is San Francisco going to finally provide public restrooms to its people 24 hours a day? Making the people defecate and relieve themselves on the streets is not only inhumane, it is a public health issue. People have to use the bathroom, and denying this basic need is also denying a basic right. And this is something you hear a lot, Paul, I know. He says, my question has to do with what can the average person do to help the homeless? I'm overwhelmed by my encounter with homeless individuals, the bottomless despair, the immensity of the problem, and the whole injustice of the system. Does it help to give a dollar here and there? Should I be writing letters, donating to soup kitchens? Are there organizations that are particularly good that I can support? Well, I'm sure you'd mention rap in that context, but, you know, people ask me all the time, should I give a buck to somebody who's got a sign who looks desperate and is holding up a sign saying anything will help or please give me some money?
If I have an extra buck in my pocket and I feel like giving it to them, I do. If I don't, I don't. Either way, it's not going to address poverty and homelessness in America today. It's more just about, you know, that dude John Carroll writes a funny thing every Christmas around Untied Way or whatever. You know, it's a personal choice, and it makes you feel good sometimes, and it definitely makes the recipient feel good. And, you know, I think the main thing, both the one that wrote about the car, that's part of our bill. If you're in a legally parked car or you have permission of the owner to be in that vehicle, they would no longer be able to arrest you for sleeping in it. The hygiene centers is part of the Homeless Bill of Rights campaign. So is legal representation against these citations. There are other segments of this campaign that try to address hygiene centers should be a no-brainer. It should be a no-brainer. Why, like, you know, why wouldn't you want to have hygiene centers? That we used to use, when I was homeless, we used to use the showers down at the beach. I forget the name of it, down in Fisherman's Wharf area. We used to use those showers. The as part of the variants that the big hotels got, like the Hilton Hotel and stuff, those are public bathrooms.
And you're getting a lot of questions again about how you went from homelessness to homeowner. Can you give us a brief?
I got freaking lucky. We bought a shack in Bernal Heights 20 years ago for $175,000. And if you can come up with 10%, and this was before the crash, so it really wasn't a lot of scrutiny around our ability to get it. But the dude really liked my wife, Mary Kate, also has worked in mental health issues and worked in mental health programs around homelessness for years until Gavin Newsom attacked her program because of who she was married to. You know, we were able, through our family and through the generosity of the homeowner that sold it to us, to be able to afford a place to live. She was born and raised here, and he thought that was a really big deal that we'd be able to get in before the stuff hit the fan. We would never be able to afford that today. Never be able to even close to be able to afford that today. But I ain't going to hide that I'm a homeowner. I ain't ashamed of it.
You should be proud. Here's Stephen from San Francisco who writes, I recently rented a room to a single mom with two kids who lives paycheck to paycheck. One of the reasons is because I didn't want to see the kids being homeless. Still, I have costs to cover, and I worry they may not be able to pay the rent. She has a job, but I think not earning a living wage is a big cause of homelessness.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a capitalist system. If you don't got money, you're in serious trouble.
And we'll get more of our callers on. Jesse, good morning.
Hi. I had a brief spill with homelessness, and I fell into the good efforts of Food Not Bombs, which is an agency that serves people on the street and it's organic, vegan food. And when I got back on my feet again, I started to work with them. And what I've seen over the past year, now that I've been working with Food Not Bombs, is there is an incredible amount of people who don't have proper access to most basic needs, and they depend regularly on Food Not Bombs for food, even though it's not funded by the state. It's an independent organization that's run completely 100% by volunteers. And the whole project for me has been deeply moving, but really incredibly disturbing that people aren't even having access to food. Thank you.
Thank you.
And cities across the country are criminalizing Food Not Bombs again. And remember the big battles here with Agnos and Feinstein and Food Not Bombs.
I remember them quite vividly.
But the sharing of food is becoming a major criminal offense in cities across the country.
I was also saying to Paul Bowden before we went on air, I remember when Mayor then Art Agnos called me in and had all these wooden blocks and graphs and blackboards and everything about how, I mean, from his social worker perspective, which was his background, how to end the homeless problem, which brings up an interesting question. I mean, you've just blasted Newsom. I'm thinking about Agnos' attempts with homeless. Who really made the most strides, in your judgment? What leadership? And how do you think Ed Lee's doing?
Well, and Bob Prentice writes about some of the changes that actually came out of respecting the process of the Coalition on Homelessness and the community input that was facilitated by the coalition. By far, I feel that Agnos had the best staff. He had very smart,
and
very
Scott
committed.
Schaefer, our own Scott Schaefer.
Scott was there. Scott was in the mayor's office, press office, I believe, at the time. And Carla Javits, who is still around and still doing stuff with nonprofit development around housing. And the Community Housing Partnership, which was a major endeavor of housing developers and homeless organizations working together to create housing and hire homeless people to rehab and fix up those buildings, which is where they're all dual diagnosed and they're all incompetent comment so irks me. Because when we had the funding and we had the resources, we were able to create hundreds of units of housings for poor people, for homeless people, by hiring homeless people to do it. It was a WPA-type approach, and it could still happen today if only the freaking federal government would fund it.
We've come to the end of the program. Paul, thanks for spending the time with us. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
His book, again, is House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. And you can order it by going to the RAP website, raphome.org. Thank you for being a part of the program. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our senior editor is Dan Zolt. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.